had gone out of the country for 2.5 months over in Kathmandu. So it's great to come back and see you all, familiar Sangha, and some high school visitors, and some people from out of town. So, welcome all. Maybe I can sketch a little, maybe slightly messy portrait of this time in Nepal. So much happened. That's why it might be kind of messy. And I'll probably just will forget many things. It seems like a long time ago when I left here. It was a real Dharma feast for me. I try to offer Dharma feasts here, and I feast a little myself too, but this was really a time where I think I did give one Zen teaching to a group of Tibetan monks at one of the monasteries. But apart from that, I was just sitting at a huge table with many, many courses, and it was very nourishing, and I'm still absorbing some of this feast. A lot of learning, a lot of just learning many things, pages and pages of notes. Kathmandu is like, particularly the area of Kathmandu where I was staying with my partner Shoho, where she's going to school. It's like the Tibetan Buddhist area. So there's just, 90% of the people walking around, if not everybody, is some kind of Dharma practitioner. Maybe half the people in the streets are monks and nuns, walking around shopping like everybody else in their maroon robes and filling the restaurants and so on too. Daily life, but there's so many of them in this area. Many monasteries, every block or so, there's another huge monastery. The daily life of the shopkeepers and lay people, also very devotional. And most of the people are Tibetan in this area, not Nepali. Almost every Tibetan, it's rare to see a Tibetan walking around without holding a mala beads in their hand, and kind of like, maybe not always, but often just, reciting mantra, like kind of quietly as they walk to work or home for the day. So it's a little bit maybe like it's like keeping their culture alive in a place where they're kind of like a minority, even though there's thousands of them in this area. But I think this Buddhism really pervades their culture. And this area, this town called Bodha, or Bodhnath, is built around this giant stupa, which is a representation of Buddha's mind. And to relate to that, to relate to Buddha's mind, kind of to remember Buddha's mind, it's kind of like at dawn and dusk, the whole town seems to turn up and circumambulate the stupa, walk around the stupa. It's big enough, it takes about 10 minutes to walk all the way around. Some people may be very, very devoted, some people actually, doing prostrations the whole way around, and some just like hanging out and talking or on their cell phone as they walk around. So it's kind of informal, but it's still, you're walking that way. It's always clockwise around a stupa, so Shoho and I would call it a rush hour. And, as the sun's going down, and gradually this crowd builds up, and if you try to kind of like walk even 50 feet upstream, you can't really do it. You got to go around. It's like a sea of people. So it's just and the energy there is just very beautiful, just to see that. We might say, well, what's that got to do with our practice of meditation? But I think it's a more like expression of devotion, and people relate to the stupa as Buddha's mind. So it's, and you honor Buddha's mind by walking around it. So it's like a reminder, and because of that, it's kind of like it's charged up by like the practice energy of many centuries of every day relating to this object like this. So you feel it. So after class, it's all very near where we were living in the monastery we were studying. So after class, you know, it's a little out of the way, but of course, we go by the stupa on the way home, do a lap or two. And, you know, you come around the corner and you see this particular stupa. You maybe have seen pictures because it's well known. It's got these eyes. In Tibet, they don't have, it's a particularly Nepali thing, these kind of big Buddha eyes. They're probably 10 feet tall. So you see it from afar and you feel a kind of radiance. And hard to know. Is that from the stupa? Is it from those people walking around it? Or is it from oneself? But this path of Vajrayana, the indestructible vehicle, or Tantra Yana, or Mantra Yana, or Pala Yana. Pala is like the fruition vehicle. Or the Upaya Yana, the path of skillful means, are all names for this form of Tibetan Buddhism. Also, it's in Japan, and it's a form of Mahayana in Buddhism. And really, like, largely, I mean, I don't even... I'm a little scared to even start talking about Vajrayana, because it's just this huge topic, and this is a lot of what I was studying over there. But it's a path of devotion. Devotion's very central. So something happens in our heart as a practitioner, our heart opening in a practice of devotion. Is we meet others. There's devotion to the teachers, very emphasized. There's devotion to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and in this openness, the blessings come from the Buddhas. And one teaching I heard over there this time was something like. Maybe how do these blessings come? The blessings manifest in the form of more opening of our heart and more kind of spaciousness and light. And one teacher said, this depends like maybe especially like devotion to the teacher. We might even say to the Buddhas too. It depends maybe like 10% of this depends on the teacher and their realization and their being or the Buddha's being. 10% depends on the circumstances of the meeting, and the other 80% depends on the practitioner's openness and devotion. I thought that's kind of interesting. So it's not like, okay, I'm just here, Buddha, just let your blessings descend on me. It's more like we have to open our heart of devotion. It's maybe the main thing. And Vajrayana is also the path of pure perception. Pure perception. Which is basically like intentionally and in a somewhat contrived way at least to begin with, seeing everybody and everything as like pure Buddhas and a Buddha realm. So, you know, we don't naturally see that way, right? People like bother us. So this is like cultivating intentionally, like remembering with the inspiration of teachings and this type of practice, trying to see, and maybe starting with a teacher or someone we feel is really inspiring us, and then but we spread that to everybody and try to see everybody as a like a fully awakened Buddha. And we know that everybody has this Buddha nature, and usually we see, we can trust that they have Buddha nature, but we also see, but their Buddha nature seems pretty obscure by all these layers of habitual stuff. But in this pure perception practice, we see even these things that look like kind of messed up are actually a pure display of like perfect wisdom. We try it on, you know, and it changes us. If we start relating that way more and more, it's people start to seem kind of different. Even their like faults start to seem like kind of amazing. But it's hard. It's a practice, right? People are Buddhas, and the world is like a pure land. There's this. They don't have a very good like garbage disposal system in Nepal, in the city there, like. None at all. So there's these places where they're kind of between buildings. There's this path near Sho's house where it's like just a kind of like a garbage dump by default. Last year when I was there, like a group of local people like cleaned it all up and put all these signs up. Don't throw garbage here. Keep this nice. And it was beautiful when I left there. When I came back this year, it was just piles. Again, covering the signs that say, don't throw garbage. So we would walk through there and try to look at all these piles of multicolored garbage as like jewels all over the ground. Like this is like a pure realm. And the stray dogs and cows munching on all the garbage are like these divine beings. And it's wonderful too. I think this is something, I think we can find elements of this in our Zen practice too, but it's really forefront in this Vajrayana worldview. And as you can imagine, it's, you know, a lifetime practice. It's very easy to forget. But the culture, I think, is somewhat designed around cultivating this kind of view. So someone here was asking me the other day, because I sent some pictures of these inside of these temples, and they're a little different than the Zendo. So you've seen these Tibetan temples. It's like every inch of the walls is like painted with like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and deities and in very bright color, the walls and the ceilings and sometimes the floors. And with all kinds of stuff hanging from the ceiling, like super elaborate altars, and then during the ceremonies, it's all kinds of horns and drums and bells, and it's like walking into another realm of reality, like another world. And when somebody asks, why do you think it's like that? It's so different from the Zen aesthetic. My understanding is it's trying to create this like vision of at least the Tibetan version of this pure land of this world where everything is not like ordinary messy stuff. It's like amazing. It's like everywhere you look is Buddhas. You can't escape them in all dimensions. And they say in Vajrayana, as you cultivate this pure perception, it's all appearances are the deities. All sounds is the sound of mantra, which is like the pure speech of the Buddhas and these deities. And all appearances and all thoughts are dharmakaya, like perfect wisdom. So our body, speech, and mind is all like completely like pure manifestation of these Buddha realms. And I think to help the practitioner cultivate this kind of view, they like go to great lengths sometimes to like visually and auditorily display this kind of realm. And you know, personally for me, it works quite well. If you spend a lot of time in those places, you start getting into the mood. It's like mood enhancer, aesthetics. And I would say same thing in a zendo like this, in a Japanese zen hall. In Japan, there's usually like at a zen temple, there's a Buddha hall and a zen sangha hall. And the Buddha hall is a little less elaborate than the Tibetan temples, but they're pretty elaborate too. There's a lot of gold stuff hanging from the ceiling and ornateness, Baroque aesthetics in the Buddha hall. But then in the meditation hall, it's like this. There's nothing on the walls. It's very plain, very simple. And I think, again, it's to cultivate, the mind we're cultivating here is a mind of like total simplicity, but kind of open, spacious lightness. And I think this endo in particular is very moving to me. I think it works for me too. This kind of beautiful simplicity. So in Japan, you know, you get up from the beautiful simplicity and then you go into the Buddha hall and you kind of like invoke this pure realm of like Buddha land. So in Tibetan, they don't really have the meditation halls, as one of my friends over there said. People come over here to Nepal like looking to learn meditation, but they don't realize people don't do meditation in the way that we usually think of, like silent sitting as a group. Of course, there's Dzogchen and Mahamudra are like the pinnacle of Tibetan Buddhism. Personally, I would say the same as like the Shikantaza of Soto Zen. But they're generally practiced kind of individually and privately in one's own room or something. And the group practice is the ritual, like services. So near the beginning of my arrival over there was Losar, Tibetan New Year, a wonderful time to be there. They get into it. You know, this is like mid, I think it's the same as Chinese New Year's, it's February, new moon. And one beautiful thing, tradition there, is that it's kind of like open hours. In all the monasteries, the teachers at all the monasteries just have like open house. So you can, and the tradition is you go visit your teachers, and or teachers you don't maybe know so well, but you want to make a connection with. It's a very auspicious time for visiting, and we do this at Green Gulch too, in Japan in the Zen tradition. But there is wonderful because I have several teachers that I've been practicing with over the years, and they all live in this part of town. So I could spend the whole day just like walking from temple to temple and visiting these teachers and just making offerings and paying respects and occasionally some teachings. Usually they're the main monastery where we were, Shoa and I were practicing and there's the school where she's learning, is Choki Nima Rinpoche, wonderful, great being. And it's a large and very active place. 300 or so monks live there. And then all these Westerners in a kind of like modern academic setting going to school, kind of accredited, you know, bachelor and master's and PhD degrees through the local university, but a mix of kind of modern, like half the teachers are Westerners and half are Tibetans. And interesting mix of like traditional monastic education, which is the class But I took one class there, which was taught by a Tibetan monk, very, very thorough. This is our year of studying the middle way here at Zen Center, and this class was on the middle way, so it was perfect timing. Middle way, particularly what we call Madhyamaka, means the middle way. But the view and teachings of Nagarjuna and then his successors in the Indian tradition, this was particularly on the teachings of Chandrakirti, the 7th century Indian commentator on Nagarjuna, and then 18th century Tibetan commentaries on Chandrakirti, and then a modern commentary on the 18th century commentary. So, I don't know, it's the kind of stuff I love, personally. I don't know, it's a certain kind of person maybe likes this kind of stuff. But it was 50 Westerners from Europe and America, and a handful of Tibetans. And some were actually brand new beginners to Buddhist practice. It's interesting seeing that some people are like, I'm struck by this idea of Buddhism, I'm going to go right to the source and spend a couple years in Nepal just learning. I'm kind of surprising to me. But it's some kind of karmic connection, right, that people end up there. And some are very long-term practitioners and been practicing over here for a long time. And there's one young man from UCSC who I know just graduated from Santa Cruz and is over there for, I don't know, the rest of his life or something. He's into it, becoming a translator and so on. These classes were like, it's an hour and a half, 5 days a week. And I kind of missed the beginning and the end. It's like about 3 months like that. So it's, you got to kind of get into it. And teacher was very great because it's the way it's written, Chandrakirti is verse, maybe 4-line verses, several hundred pages like that. So he's trying to get through the whole text. I think he's not going to finish, but sometimes we'd have 1 week of an hour and a half classes just on one verse. So that kind of like depth. And a lot of discussion, question and answer. We could say philosophy, but sometimes it's said this Madhyamaka is like not really a philosophy because it's kind of like it's the refutation of all philosophies. It's just like showing how any way that we think about things with the conceptual mind actually doesn't hold up and kind of falls apart when we start analyzing it. So it's a path of analysis through reasoning and deep inquiry, very, very careful, meticulous inquiry about our own experience, but through this particular system. Quite beautiful, especially to see the traditional presentation, which is like the structure of these texts is like this, like a tree, right? It's like, and the teacher, because this is the tradition, he would start every class, first he'd always talk about bodhicitta. The only reason we're studying this is to be completely free from suffering and to help everybody else be free from suffering. And when we get caught up in the details, if we forget that, the whole thing's pointless. So it's nice to spend maybe 10 minutes talking about this every day. Bodhicitta. And then he'd lay out the structure of the text. We're studying the necklace of spotless crystal, Nipam's commentary on Chandrakirti's entrance into the middle way. It's like, as if we didn't know that. We've been studying that every day for 3 months. But he, here's the title, which takes like a minute just to say it, right? And then we're studying the 6th chapter, which is broken into these 4 parts. The 4th part is broken into these 2 parts, and he'd name all the parts. The 2nd part is broken into 4 parts. The 3rd part of that is broken into 5 parts, and we're on part A of the 5th part. Kind of like take you down this thing to this one verse, because it's very skillful, I thought, because otherwise you read this verse and like, what happened yesterday again? Like, where are we actually? It kind of like takes you down to where you are, and then you get into the detail. So later this year we have a class on Nagarjuna, so maybe some of these teachings will come through. I've been studying Nagarjuna and Madhyamaka for a while, but I learned a lot. New takes, new twists, because it's so thorough. Sometimes surprising takes. And of course, within a tradition like this, you have diverging views that a lot of people disagree. And so there's, without defining the final word, we say, well, here's the arguments, and, you know, see, what do you think? So in some ways, it's like this kind of encapsulates a little bit this Tibetan Buddhist view, and I think you can find similarities in Zen too. There's this one approach of, like, you know, deep conceptual study like this. This is a unique conceptual study because it's the conceptual study that unravels all conceptuality. It's the point of this particular Madhyamaka project. But that's one path to kind of like open and touch Buddha nature, is through this path of inquiry, like meticulous inquiry into, like, what is happening in our experience right now, but through this, you know, structured way that these ancestors have left us. And then that's just considered Mahayana. Nagarjuna is one of our Zen ancestors too. But then the Vajrayana is kind of complementary to this, and this is not the path of analytical inquiry. This is the path of, like, direct transmission. So a little bit more like Zen. And through the blessings of the teacher was connected to authentic lineage. So then the blessings of the lineage come through. And again, 80% is the openness and devotion of the student. And then the skillful means is opening to this reality of Buddha nature, kind of through, like, this world of, they usually translate it as deity, but this includes, like, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and kind of personal deities and Dharma protectors, but they're seen as, because this is merged with this middle way view, they're completely empty of any, like, substance. These deities, there's nothing there, actually. But they're like, they manifest just like us. When we look for us, really, there's nothing there. I mean, there's nothing substantial. We can't find any independent self or any substance to anything. And yet, there's an appearance is manifesting, very dynamic. So, in a way, these, like, unseen beings are like that. In this view. But you might also have heard of, like, these three bodies of a Buddha. So Buddha nature also has these three bodies. Our Buddha nature, our awakened true nature that we all share, according to this view, is like, has this Dharmakaya nature, which means, like, the nature of our mind, and which is basically our experience, is completely ungraspable. That's what we call emptiness. When we try to find anything substantial, we can't actually get a hold of anything. That's like the Dharmakaya nature of our own experience. And then the Sambhogakaya nature is like a kind of clarity or luminosity quality of our experience. So there's nothing actually we can get a hold of here. Everything's completely ungraspable. And yet, it's like vividly appears like this. It's like the appearance of a world out of emptiness. And this Sambhogakaya quality is where these so-called deities play. They're like luminosity They're not just empty space, and they're not like so solid as this third body of Buddha is, the Nirmanakaya quality. And that's also appearances, but appearances that like we all agree on, like the conventional world of what seems like solidity. So these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in these pure realms are like the clear, bright quality of Buddha nature. And therefore, we don't meet them in the way that we meet, like, the floor. We don't meet them in such a gross way, right? But we can meet them. This is the Vajrayana view. And again, this is not so different from Zen. Zen has these same elements, it's just we don't emphasize them as strongly. Like when we do service in the morning and we chant the Heart Sutra, celebrating emptiness, and then we the merit from that chanting, the kind of positive energy, we dedicate it, we offer it to these Buddhas, and we offer an incense to the Buddhas. So maybe we don't think so much necessarily what that means or where that comes from, but I think it's the same idea. Is like, I think Suzuki Roshi even said, the meaning of offering incense is to ask Buddha to come. It's like, could be like a straight up Vajrayana statement. So we invoke these Sambhogakaya expressions of luminosity. They come in particular forms, right? There's hundreds, maybe thousands, in the Vajrayana of these deities. Some come very peaceful, gentle forms. Some are like ferocious, wrathful, like blood dripping, you know, head chopping, wild sex having beings. You've seen the images, right? So it's like the full expression of human experience manifest as, and they're all like, you know, completely enlightened beings. One teacher, somebody asked him about, well, what's with the, like, these wrathful, fierce, fanged, angry-looking, fire and shrouded beings? What's with their compassion? And the story was, those so-called wrathful deities, they are the ones that have, like super, super deep, wide-open, total love and compassion, that they're able to manifest that way. Because if they don't, they shouldn't manifest that way. And the peaceful ones, like, maybe are also have that, but they don't have, their compassion doesn't have to be as completely developed, because people don't get fooled by it. They're very nice, so people like them anyway. But these wrathful ones are like, they're to cut through, like, our in a very loving, compassionate way, cut through our delusions and self-clinging. And there, we meet them through offering incense, as Suzuki Roshi says, and in that tradition, even more elaborate display of offerings. It's, a lot of it is about offerings, making offerings. And mantra is also a way to that's like their language. So that's a way to like contact them in this tradition. And and also just our devotion is a way to contact them. So that's a lot of what Vajrayana practice is about, is relating to the unseen beings that all like pervaded by this view of Madhyamaka emptiness. So people who just see it from the outside, just it looks like some sort of just shamanistic folk religion, but as you get into it, it's like, the whole point is to kind of like express and relate to these emptiness teachings. and teachings about the mind, and that these beings are not separate from us. Just a little bit more about this Vajrayana teaching is that there's these like kind of levels of kind of like different yanas, right? We have these yanas that are sort of like paths or vehicles, and in Zen we talk about the Shravaka vehicle, the Pratyeka Buddha vehicle, and the Bodhisattva vehicle. So they're kind of like they build on each other in a way, and then they have those three also. But then they keep build. Then Tantra or Vajrayana starts from there, and there's like six more vehicles. And the basic thing is that they're like that. These beings, like the Buddhas, in the lower tantric vehicles, they're like separate from us. So, which is often, I think, in our tradition, how we relate to them. Buddha's like kind of this awesome realized being, and we're kind of humbly making offerings to Buddha. And these Vajrayana levels kind of start there, but as they get more advanced, they are more, maybe we could say, subtle layers of this. You become less and less separate from the being that you're making offerings to, until the fullest expression is that being is you. Or you, in a way, you start the practice with them outside, but then you merge with them completely. And I think that the lower vehicle is like, that's too much. No, don't merge with them. It's maybe a little arrogant. But these higher paths is like becoming more and more like no separation. In a way, they're moving towards non-duality, and then the pinnacle of this, of these levels, is what we call Dzogchen, what we call Soto Zen. We don't have all the tantric stuff, but in a way, like our the view and practice of our zazen as presented by Dogen Zenji, as I understand it, is like the kind of pinnacle. And we have other skillful means in the Zen tradition. It's just that they sometimes call this Vajrayana the path of skillful means, because there's so many practices. And personally, when I was first getting into practice, I discovered Zen by coincidence, right? Like we all do. It's just, we don't know how. We stumble into our life, right? And then something struck me, some little pinprick was poked, and a little light came through, and something here worth checking out a little deeper for a while. And then after maybe a year or so of, living at Tassajara and so on, feeling like, I can see that, like, where this is going. I'm not going to get out of this. The Dharma's hooked me. So before I, like, totally fall down the Zen rabbit hole, maybe I should check out these other forms of Buddhism. And so I went to India and Nepal. This was 25 years ago, and to check out Vajrayana, but at that point it seemed like it was too late. I had this connection to Zen, and I checked it out some, but like the connections didn't come together. For example, this teacher, Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche, that I feel deeply connected with, especially after these 3 months over there, I went to see him, he gives like a talk for the Westerners in English, like every week. Starting, even 25 years ago. And I remember, because I'd heard about this, you gotta go see Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche. And I was like, I had like the runs, India had caught up with me, and I couldn't get out of bed on that Saturday. I'll go next week. Next week he was out of town. So I didn't connect. And I also thought, like, my mind is pretty elaborate already. I needed a kind of like a simple path. Zen really drew me in that way. And after many years of practicing Zen, and the Tibetan, similar practices to Zen of like Dzogchen, then I see, well, Dzogchen really comes in this package, this Vajrayana package. That's not that interesting. I'm really into the pure non-dual awareness part. But like, the more you do these retreats and meet with these teachers, well, there's this other stuff around it. So just in the last, 5 years or so, my heart really opens to this Vajrayana world. It's a wonderful, kind of a new world for me. So they also, over there, they one practice they do that was near the end of my stay that was just really enjoyed. It's called Drubchen. Some people know Drubchen? No, Corrine does. Because at Pema Osaling, down the road here, they do a very authentic Drubchen every year. It's kind of like, in a way, it's like the Vajrayana version of Sesshin. But it's quite different from Sesshin. Because Sesshin, we're all about silence, right? We do a little like ritual chanting, but mostly silence for 7 days. Or something like that. And Drubchen is always 9 days, but it's seven full days, but the afternoon before and the morning after. And so I think maybe came from those same roots as the 7 day Sesshin. And but there's no silence, at least in these ones I did. Not even like a half a minute. In these we would joke about it, some of us, because the structure of Vajrayana ritual practice is some are short and some are, Drubchen is like the super elaborate version, but you basically, you create a mandala, you create this pure realm, through creative imagination and, physical enactment also, and mantra recitation you could say symbolic in a way, a very beautiful symbolic creation of this world, and enter it fully because it's all day. And actually, some people keep it going all night. It's like a 24-hour, 7 day, 9 day, 7 day, seven full days. And then there's this part, even if you just do this as your own daily practice, the part at the end of every sadhana, they call it, at the end of every, ritual invocation, you do they call it dissolution phase, where you invoke the deity and you become the deity. You've created through pure perception this world, and then you always dissolve it into like total non-conceptual space. At the end, it's kind of the Madhyamaka, element. It's like now you just rest in total awareness, which is often, maybe originally this was like the main point. All of this elaborate stuff is just to really open your mind and heart, and then you just drop into it very easily. I think it's quite brilliant. I feel like as a skillful means, but in this, you've been doing this creation phase for like 12 hours or so, and then near the end of the day, you do the dissolution, and I think in the West, people like, you dissolve and then you rest for at least, 10 minutes, if not like 40 minutes, like Zazen, right? But there's a certain ritual element where you dissolve, and then it's like they wait 1 second, and then you just pick up the rest of the conclusion activity. Wow, like this whole thing was all for this 1 second. And actually one of the teachers said, yeah, that is the center of the entire ritual. But it's kind of like symbolic. 1 second. But if you kind of like from this viewpoint, if you take up this viewpoint, it's like you see that that 1 second actually is no different from like 10,000 eons. Because your mind is in that kind of open space, so time is no longer an issue and so on. In that view, so maybe that's why they're like, it doesn't matter if we are silently sitting for an hour or 1 second. And it kind of goes along with their understanding. So many, many other beautiful memories, but I could tell a lot of other stories, but maybe this sparks some questions about that whole practice. Yes?
So you're chanting for these 9 days?
Offerings? Yeah, just to lay out, just to paint a little picture of Drupa Chen a little bit. So the afternoon to begin is kind of a neat thing because you set up the boundaries, and which is like these four guardian kings. There's like you put out these shrines and the four directions around the monastery, and you make offerings to them. And you're like, so you're in a way creating this pure space. And then I think traditionally it's like I've heard that nobody leaves that space for the 9 days, but in modern times, most of the people don't even live at the monastery. So you come and go, but when you enter that, it's the mandala. It's called the mandala. It's bit, hundreds of feet diameter. And you come in and you kind of like have to drink some pure substances and kind of like re-enter it every time you enter it again. So it's pretty elaborate just to set up the space. And then they build a mandala inside the shrine hall. Very elaborate. And it's a lot about substances, which is quite interesting because I see a lot of parallel to a Christian, that the center of the Christian ritual is about partaking of substances, which are in a way sort of kind of magical. This is definitely part of Vajrayana too. And so you're kind of like putting substances into the mandala that you will at the end of the 9 days take out and everybody will partake of. And that's when like maybe 1,000 people from the town come and just completely fill the entire grounds, even though they weren't there for any of the ritual, because it's like this is where you receive the cities. You receive the kind of like magic in a way. And it's quite something. But then during the 9 days, it's like visualize a boundary each day. You expel obstructors by basically making offerings to the obstructors, and it's all the view is all of this is your mind, but it's being played out externally. The obstructors are your own delusions, so you feed them and you tell them to like get out, and then you kind of like, and you kind of, if you get into it, you kind of feel like that worked. They're gone. They're taken care of. They're outside the mandala now. And this is like, there are no delusions in here anymore. And all sights are the sights of deities. All sounds are mantra, even if people are just having an argument. All thoughts are dharmakaya, even if it's like, what time is lunch? Wow! And then, yeah, it's like chanting, but very musical. Beautiful, melodic. Some of it's like our rhythmic drum chanting, but because it goes on all day, they need some variation. So all different, very beautiful melodies. And you're invoking the deities, you're making lots of mentally and physically created offerings. You're connecting with them through the mantra. And then this particular, this last, there were like three different Drupa Chens while I was there, but this last one was like, so they're based on different deities each time. This was a kind of amending, purification. So like our full moon ceremony is a kind of mending and purification of our bodhisattva precepts as a monthly thing. This is like a elaborate annual and a semi-elaborate monthly version of like the tantric samaya is like precepts basically. And so it's kind of confession and repentance ceremony actually in the Vajrayana style, which is like mending your samaya, and which is like commitments. You're mending your commitments with like all these thousands of deities if you've gone against their pure mind. I think very same spirit, I think, as with a kind of strange twist. and then empowerment, this particular Dzogchen also involved these Abhisheka, is like these daily empowerments. And in Zen too, we have Abhisheka. It's kind of smaller part, but I think this came from Japanese Vajrayana, blending with Zen. I don't know how this arose, but in Soto Zen, in our ordination ceremonies, we do this water sprinkling, and that's called Abhisheka. And it's the, you know, from a Vajrayana point of view, that would be the apex of our like Jukai ceremony, is putting water into the head top. We might see this is just a little purification thing, but actually that's like the empowerment or the initiation. And it comes from like water, the way that they would crown kings in ancient India, with like water from all the oceans being poured on top of their head. So and in Vajrayana there's very elaborate Abhishekas that involve these different ways of doing it. That would be like maybe the, yeah, anyway, so that's part of the daily thing. And and then you, once you have that initiation into that deity, you're like, you have a, like a lifetime commitment basically to these beings and to these samaya. In modern times, I think in old times it was like you have do a lot of preliminary practice before any Abhisheka, but in modern times they're almost like a blessing, so they're just constantly doing these empowerments. Anybody can, some of them are more closed, some are like just drop in. And if as Westerners, people often don't even know it, yeah, yeah, just get some blessings. But they don't know that they actually like took these vows. And I mean, this happened to me like, you know, 20 years ago or something. And then over the years, oh, I guess I did that actually. I didn't really realize it at the time. But I think those seeds were like, I feel like they're opening now from those old times. I think there's something mysterious in the Dharma world in general about how things work. And then at the conclusion of the day of Dzogchen, there's a beautiful part where the mandala is like this kind of tower with kind of secret stuff inside it. And you kind of then circumambulate, the other Dharma teachers circumambulate it, and with a song, and it's very beautiful. End of the day, kind of like we chant the refuges at the end of the night of Sesshin, that spirit. And then at the end they open it up, and that's when all the people come. And they also, this element of, there's no silence because there's all this chanting and singing. And we had the, you know, English text for this one. I mean, the book that you go through each day is like 150 pages. It's like a long ritual. But it's beautiful to see it in English. You can chant in Tibetan, but you can read the, understand the meaning. Otherwise, I think it's quite different. And then the last day, they start blowing the horns. These, you know, they have these like 10-foot long trumpet-like horns, which they play all through the ceremony to kind of like obliterate your conceptual mind, which actually, again, I find quite effective. You're chanting and chanting, and then at the certain like key moments of the chant where it's like, and now just a rain of blessings pours everywhere, they just erupt into the horns and drums and cymbals and bells, and it's pretty loud. they're all around the room, so you're just surrounded by sound that like you can't think. anymore. I think that's the point of it, actually. And then, but then they go up on the roof and they turn up all the lights and they blow these horns starting at 1 a.m. And, you know, we'd lived like a mile, maybe a mile or half a mile. And so it's the whole town. You could hear from our apartment in the distance these horns. It's like the whole town maybe wakes up. But in this culture, they love it. Because this is Drupchen, it's the morning of bestowing the blessings. And then the practice starts at 2:30. This is just the last day. The last morning is like you do this, you do the whole day, but before dawn. And then at dawn, you open the mandala, and Amrita goes flying everywhere. And it's just kind of like the end of Sesshin, like super exuberant, except we're kind of more subdued in the Zen world. It's a great celebration. And you know, I think when I first got into Buddhist practice, if I just came across that first, I would have been like, what is going on here? What does this have to do with anything? And what does this have to do with like relieving suffering and like my ordinary life? And I think that's why I didn't find it at that time. But now I think it helped with the understanding of practice through Zen. I see it as a very beautiful expression of practice. Same purpose as Zazen, actually. Just a very different expression. That's kind of like the Drupchen. And they would have, for lunch, they would... It's amazing, too, because the devotion, people from all over, like Taiwan and China, would come just for the Drupchen. And Westerners would fly from America just for that week. So it's, wow, I guess this is something's happening here. And people would come, like, every year for years and years. It's kind of special. This one in particular... They would kind of like sponsor a lunch for everybody. So even if you're not, anyone can just come, and everything's just offered too. And it's like a lot is happening, but people are so generous because there's this feeling of you just like the spirit is just like flood the world with generosity. That's this part of this pure vision, right? So we'd have lunch in another building, but breakfast reminded me a little of Orioki, because you're chanting, and the monks have their own little bowl and their sort of like tables in front of them, and we'd all squeeze in, it was very packed in wherever you could fit, and then somebody comes and if you don't have a bowl, they hand out plates to everybody, and then it's kind of like while you're chanting, they come and start serving everybody food. A couple hundred people, and it takes a while. And then there's a certain part where they like, and it will be a different part every day depending on the timing, where they stop that chant and they just go right into like a meal chant, and then you just eat like Orioki for like 5 minutes, right? 5 or 6 minutes. And then boom, you just go right back into the chanting. But even then it wasn't silent. Because as soon as it would go silent, or also the mantra recitation part, when you're doing like the longer time of mantra, is you do kind of, you have your mala and it's just mumble. So it's like most of it's out loud together, but the mantra itself is like, some people do it fast, some do it slow. But when it would go kind of like into this hum, anytime there wasn't group chanting, the little monks, which were like, they're so cute. There's, you know, maybe 20 or so like 5-year-old monks, little shaved heads in maroon robes, right? I never got the full story, but I think it's like these devout Buddhist parents just give them to the monastery, I think is how it works. And then as they get older, I think they can choose, they don't have to stay. But also they get an education that way. kind of amazing education. So they're neat, and they start training from like 5 years old. So they're the ones who, whenever it goes silent for a meal or for individual mantra recitation, they sing the mantra chain. There's like 5 different mantras, very beautiful melody, and they're good. They're quite good. And they're also the ones that keep it going all night in shifts. The older monks get to sleep. As the novices get to go through the ringer like that. But I think they get treated very kindly, actually. And another beautiful little story here, just about the cute monks. They run around and play all the time, too. They're really that allowed to play. They're not really like going to school yet, I think. And Jogi Nyima Rinpoche, he's, you know, have like sort of office hours. It's sort of like a big dokusan room, like bigger than the zendo. And it's kind of like, there's not, maybe there's occasionally his senior students maybe could have private meetings, but it's like open group dokusan, like visiting hours. And you can go and have a personal conversation, but it's in this room of people. And it's quite a neat thing, actually. Because you can just go hang out and listen to, it's like just Dharma conversation, often profound. And one time, it was like the day a few days before I left, and he was leaving for like a month. He travels all around the world constantly teaching. And I wonder if I want to say goodbye and make a last offering, and I wonder if he'll be in the, probably won't be in the office today because they say he has to leave for the airport at 10 and it's 9 o'clock now. And but no, you could, as you come in, you'd see if his window's open up there, right? Yeah, window's open. You go up and he's talking with the monks or something, doing business, right? And it's getting like 9:30. He's probably going to just leave. But he's so just, he's just this amazing, available person. He would just meet you, and he's kind of in this timeless realm. So if he didn't have an attendant, he probably would just always miss his flight. So he's just there, and like the stream of people wants to see him. Kind of go up one at a time, and he meets you. And each person really meets, even for these New Year's greeting where there's a line that goes all the way out the gate and down the street. You know, he really, when you finally get to him, it's like you can have a conversation, and he remembers what you're practicing. I mean, it's, I don't know how he works. He's quite something. And so he's just doing the Dharma thing. He's into like, you know, he's got some videos. He's, say, hey, with the laptop, check this out. He's kind of modern. He's modern lama. And he must be have to go soon. His attendant was, remember, say, you know, it's, you're playing. Oh, okay. But he really doesn't, some more people come in, he's like, come. And then as it's getting time to leave, this older monk comes in with a group of 6 or 7 of the cute monks and that we hadn't seen before. And they had a little we call it shura. If you've seen the priest ordination ceremonies, we leave this little spot of hair. You shave the head all around, you leave the last spot, and then the teacher, as Buddha, cuts it off, the last trace. And so they, same tradition, it's very old, right? They come in with these little top knots because they're about to be ordained. And I don't know if this teacher knew that he was about to ordain them before they came. This is prearranged, but this is kind of the sort of informality of this realm. It's very, it's like this. They come in, the older monk says something to him. Oh, okay, come. And this group of all these Westerners and people taking photos and he comes and cuts their hair. I take refuge in Buddha, repeat after me, you know. And we repeat the refuges, just like our ceremony, and like, that was like this little ordination, and they take him out. Like, wow. On his way to the airport, just before he runs out of the room, he like ordains like 7 of these novices at a
I'm like, I turned to Shaho, I'm like, this is like a major occasion for these people's life just happened. I think they don't really know it yet. And I think it's not fully like the precepts. I think it's just like a refuge thing, but you know, they're in the monk's robes. It's like a pre-novice ordination. But I just thought, that was so wonderful. It's just how it's just spontaneous. And you know, I think there's a very formal kind of training as you go along through this, but this informal thing was kind of neat too, because one last story from the Drukchen, just to this picture of these monks are like super trained. It's like, you know, all these mudras and mantras and instruments, and it's like our services, but you know, super elaborate. And they're going out the door, making different offerings, and so they're just doing. They're holding that space, and then there's all these people, and then the teachers are in the seats in front, kind of like the doshi. They do their different parts, but they're just there. Also all day, but then there's this thing of like you come up and you offer a kata, right? It's these white scarves. It's just simple way of whenever you meet a teacher, you offer a kata, but some people have offered a tray of food. So all day long, in the middle of this elaborate ritual, there's this stream, mostly of Nepali and Tibetan local people, just walking into the middle of the ceremony. And going up to the teachers and offering them, and the teacher will meet them, and like sometimes talk a little bit in the middle of the chanting. They can stop. And I thought, in Zen, that would be like so taboo to walk up to the doshi and start having a conversation. But in this world, it's like the normal thing. And sometimes to the point where it's like, it would get crazy by the last days. You'd have these lines of people coming in, because a lot of it is just like, meet this connection. It's this guru yoga is really a big part of Vajrayana. So it's like, and there'd be people all like crammed in below them, and the attendants would have to like push the people so that they could, the people could meet them. And sometimes it'd be like, you'd know kind of what they have to do. And this is the part where they have to ring the bell and, even during the empowerments, they hold something up that you gaze at, and this is the center of the empowerment. Right as they're doing that, there's all these Nepalis that are oblivious to how the ceremony works. They're hi Rinpoche, how you doing? And the Rinpoches never would say like, no, not now. Oh, okay. They almost like if they're holding up the thing over here, hi, how you doing? It was so beautiful. They're just never like interrupted. Or like disturbed by what was happening. It was really an impressive teaching to me. So there's some stories. From Nepal. Lots of stories. It was a wonderful time, very nourishing, and great to be with Shoho over there. She felt very supported. And she's coming back well-fed on her feast, mm-hmm. her three-year feast. And I just thank you all so much for supporting me to go there by continuing the practice here, especially Patrick and Jean leading the practice period. And I hear it was a wonderful time here while I was gone. I'm sorry to have missed it. And let's keep practicing together. Zen. We enter the Zen world of total simplicity. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow
surrender. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow.